Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Good afternoon, good morning, good evening, wherever you are in the world. I'm Russell Tovey.
And I'm Robert Diament.
And this is Talk Art.
Welcome to Talk Art.
How are you today, Rob?
Today, Russell, I am feeling like a keen observer, because every time I have met today's guest, that's something that struck me about him. I feel like he absorbs everything that's going on around him in a really kind of contemplative way. And I also feel like he is on the precipice of something very exciting, because his debut book is about to be released. It's called Evenings and Weekends. And both of us have read it, and both of us, I think, cried. Didn't you cry when you read it?
I cried.
Yeah, and actually, I think it's a common thing that's happening with most people that have read the preview copies
of
this
phenomenon.
Book. Yes. Yeah, I've even seen quotes, actually, saying that people are crying when they read it. But we were sent two different preview copies quite early on, actually, last year. And yeah, it's been a real pleasure to kind of sit with this book and really think about it. And another thing I feel is truthful, because I feel like the way that he writes is so sort of truthful and accurate, and it's all kind of different issues which come together in this book, whether it be political, kind of everyday mundanity, kind of social conditions, economic conditions that affect people's lives in a really real way. And I also think it's a really beautiful dedication to living in a city, in a metropolis, and also just about our relationships with each other. And I think people really need to buy this book. It's out in early May. And I think at the core as well of what our guest does in his writing, it comes from a really artistic place. And I know the book was even supported by the Arts Council. I think the original grant or something that he got was even from the Arts Council. So it's interesting to think about him as a writer who's really an artist, but is using words to make art. And we've become friends. We've hung out. He even came to our 5th year anniversary party for Talk Art, which was just some crazy night in central London at Toklas. And we ended up in a bar very late. So we've even had our own kind of community moments, which has been very sweet.
We've so had our own evening and weekend, haven't we?
Yeah. And you were reading it on the flight somewhere. We flew somewhere. And I remember you reading it. I've got a photo of you reading the book with the old cover.
Obsessed.
Hum. So we would like to welcome to Talk Art, Oisin McKenna. Hi, Oisin.
Hi, thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. How are you feeling? I mean, you're on the precipice of your book being released. What is that emotion?
Yeah, it's strange, you know. For quite a while, I found it really scary. There was a period of time during which I felt really nervous about how people were going to perceive it, how people were going to perceive me. And I guess I'd been with the book for quite a long time. So it went through different stages of, there were certainly times when writing it or when I finished certain drafts when I felt really excited by it and really proud of it and really excited for people to read it. But there were loads of other times when I'd read it so many times that anything good about it became totally invisible to me. And I was really afraid of it being like cringe. I was like, is it cringe? Am I cringe? That was a big theme of my ruminations on it. I've got to quite an excited place with it now. I've had lots of really kind and generous feedback, which has been really fortifying. And I really love the cover. I feel really excited for it to like be in bookshops. I feel good. I feel quite chill, actually. I feel at peace with it.
That's interesting. You said you like the cover. Was that a whole process then? Because they say, you know, you shouldn't judge a book by its cover, but we should with your book.
The cover took a while, you know. We went through lots of different iterations of it. Initially, we thought about a more sort of photographic image. I guess a lot of the content in the book, it's kind of got an eye on a sort of like social history, youth culture. And we tried out lots of different photographic images, but couldn't quite find the one that worked, and went back to the drawing board and, you know, went with, you know, a kind of typographic design-led image, which... I mean, I find it very, very beautiful and very striking, designed by Joe Thompson, who's an in-house art director at Fourth Estate. But it kind of speaks to, like, I guess it looks a little bit like a rave flyer, but also it looks a little bit, it's got a sort of like semblance of a kind of like sociology textbook from like 80s, but in this very like chic way. Yeah, so it speaks to lots of different threads in the book while also being like a very beautiful, striking item, I think.
It gave me memories of like Tate as well for some reason, like Tate Museum back in the day when what's his name did the Sun installation, like Elaffer this is years Eliasson. And years ago. What's his name, Ross?
Elaffer Eliasson.
Oh yeah, Elaffer Eliasson, exactly. I don't know. It sort of took me back to a place in my life, weirdly, when I saw that the artwork to the book.
Yeah, that's nice. Yeah. I mean, it feels very evocative for me. And I mean, if it felt very important. I've thought a lot about the sort of like visual and sort of, I guess, like broadly speaking, kind of like branding identity of the book, which feels like a sort of, it's weird kind of like that coming to that place when it's an artist, it's a quite like an intimate and sensitive artistic process for a long time, but obviously one which is going to meet the world through a kind of commercial process by being published by, you know, a big commercial publisher. So I guess it goes through this process of becoming a kind of, a commodity also, which is... Yeah, that's quite a complicated process, but it feels really important that the version of that exists is something that's congruent with the like artistic integrity of the work. So I feel really pleased with how it's come out.
Rob mentions you got a bursary, so funding to write this book. How does that work when you're writing a novel and you want to get funding? How do you pitch that? Because you obviously haven't got the novel to say, hey, give me the money to write this novel. So you have to pitch an idea, and how fully formed does the idea have to be? What is that process? And for people listening who want to write a novel and they go, I want to get money to write it so I can fund myself, because it's really all consuming, I guess, when you're into it.
Yeah, it's a good question. So I guess when I initially started pitching it to the Arts Council, I guess that was that. So I'd been making theatre work, spoken word stuff, kind of like performance art, cabaret work for a number of years.
You've done four pieces. I mean, you've written and performed four theatre pieces.
Yeah, so I'd written and performed four theatre pieces, and I'd just finished touring the last one of those, which I made, which was a show called Admin. It was a solo show, so just me performing it. And I wanted to write a book for lots of different reasons. I felt I was getting a little bit bored in theatre in terms of scale of audiences and diversity of audiences. It's even if a show does really well and gets to tour, there's not that many people that get to see it. And also a lot of the work that I was really excited by was fiction and novels, and kind of always had been. And I was at a stage of my career where I felt kind of like confident enough artistically to make that happen, but also confident enough professionally to do things like apply to the Arts Council and feel that I could make a pretty good case for myself. At that stage, there wasn't really plot or characters as such, but there were some, I had like broad, like thematic kind of ideas. And I guess part of making the pitch to them at that point was also, it's also sort of making a pitch for yourself. So the project itself might not be particularly fully fleshed out at that point, but I was sort of at a stage of my own development where I could point to, you know, different things that I've done and, try to make a case that I was, a sort of interesting new voice.
It's interesting thinking about that idea of like spoken word as well, because I think when you were really young, you thought you might be a artist as like a visual artist and maybe like performance artist. And I know that there were certain people that you really looked up to. Can you speak a bit about that performative element? Because obviously that's so different to like having a book in your hands, like that we're reading.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. So I guess when I started out, or early enough in my career, I was very much attached to a kind of performance art, live art kind of scene in Dublin. And a lot of the people that I really admired at that time were people like David Hoyle, Bourgeois and Maurice,
yes.
Higgs and Wiggs, and some more American artists as well, Taylor Mack, Justin Vivian Bond, Penny Arcade. Mm. And those were people that I really aspired to be like. That was work that really, really excited me. And I sort of tried to do that for a number of years, but slowly, with each show that I made, I pared it back a little bit more. And I guess the people, I mean, something that a lot of those artists have in common is their capacity to improvise, like some more than others, but that was something that I could never really do. I mostly have always worked off text, like scripts. And I, with every show, by the time that I made my last show, it was literally just me on stage talking into a mic, sitting down while a sort of a glitter rain fell behind me for the whole show. So it was really formally really simple, but it had, yeah, come quite a long way from the sort of like big sort of bombast of some of those artists that I wanted to be like. But it was ultimately like I eventually got to a place where I realized I needed to play to my strengths, in the sense that in some ways I'm quite a shy person. I was never going to be David Hoyle, and I think it's good that I admitted that.
There's still time.
There's still time, maybe.
But if you describe yourself as a spoken word artist and you're on stage and you're reading text, when does that become an actor? Have you ever thought, I'm going to be an actor? Or have you always known that this umbrella of spoken word is what you are in?
Yeah, I mean, I guess what always felt like it made it different from acting was that when I'm on stage, I'm nearly always some version of myself. And I've worked with people who are like kind of proper actors before, like trained actors. Well, maybe proper actors is a contentious term, maybe. Well,
you can call me a proper actor, I don't mind.
Yeah, sure. Like, I guess, yeah, having worked with people who've done training as acting and the kinds of different things that they can do in terms of occupying different roles is something that's like outside of my like toolbox. Like I can do versions of myself. And I think, you know, like, so sometimes that like stretches the actual like limits of my personality and becomes more of a exaggerated persona. I don't really think I've got it. I mean, I've not certainly not got the training, and I think even if I like tried to have the training, I think I've not got the natural aptitude for that, I don't think.
And the people that you were gravitating towards, so like if you think of David Hoyle, who you mentioned very clearly there, and people like Penny Arcade as well, like when you think of them, you immediately think of them, don't you? Like it is that it's like their soul somehow, but they're these radical, like avant-garde kind of bombastic, I don't know, very over the top characters. And I read something that you wrote where it said that you were sort of interested in those kinds of artists who were in that avant-garde context, but they were somehow in the cracks between performance art and theatre, which I really loved that as a phrase. I thought it was great. So what was it that kind of drew you? How did you discover that as a kind of art form?
Yeah, I mean, I discovered those things through meeting other people who were into that world. I mean, often I think a lot of the art that I discovered in my 20s was socially, often actually through like having like romantic relationships, sometimes with people who were a little bit older than me, who were more, you know, versed in the sort of like cultural world around me. And I think, yeah, I think in terms of what like drew me to those people initially is that their work is highly political, but also highly entertaining. I've always been kind of interested in finding ways to like talk about like politics in a way that's pleasurable. Like I'm interested in pleasure in artwork, and I find watching the work of those people is like highly pleasurable. Yeah.
Well, let's talk about the book, Evenings and Weekends. It's been described as a part multi-generational literary soap opera, part state of the nation novel. And some people have made comparisons to Sally Rooney. So if you love Sally Rooney, Normal People, obviously, you know, you might connect to this book through that energy. But the story, it's set over a heat-waved weekend in June in 2019. And there's a group of friends and family. It's on the summer solstice. It involves a beached whale. And all of these characters interconnecting, and there's queerness in there, and there's you know, love, loss and desire and loneliness within a relationship and people that are unfulfilled. But it's incredibly moving and funny. And I want to play Ed. I think I'm too old for Phil, but I just want to put it out there because I'm sure you already sold the rights, film and TV. I want to be Ed. This story is just amazing. And I mean, what has it been like getting these responses, and which of the characters is you?
It's been so nice getting these responses. I guess when I was writing the book, a lot of what I wanted to do was write something that could work in both sort of critical and commercial contexts. So I was interested in writing something that was like serious, like a serious social novel, really, which was, you know, kind of rigorously engaged in thinking about what it sort of feels like to live in the political and economic structures that we live in today, but to do so in a way which was like really funny, like really pleasurable to read, which basically was like quite serious about giving readers like a good time as well. Like I wanted to make people laugh, I wanted to move people, and to see people reading it in that way is hugely gratifying. And I guess it always felt like, when I was writing it, I didn't really know if I could do it. Like for a lot of the time when I was writing it, it really didn't work. And it only started working like very near to the end of the process. And it always felt like a big gamble in the sense that I put loads and loads of like time into it. And there was always this fear that I will have, you know, I mean, what seemed at the time to have wasted loads of, you know, important time in my life. So it's hugely relieving that that's not been the case and that it's coming out and that people like it. In terms of characters, I wouldn't say that any of them straightforwardly map onto an actually existing person, but in many ways, I share a lot of personality traits with Phil.
Of course you do, yeah.
Yes, personality traits, demographic information, and some biographical events, but in lots of ways, I'm a little bit like all of the characters in different ways. I guess like one of the challenges that I found when I was writing it was that some of the characters are straightforwardly like me in terms of demographic information. Some of them are different from me in terms of age and gender, and one of the ways into writing about people whose lives have been quite different from mine was to imagine ways that they've been the same or imagine commonalities in our experience and work from there. So it's actually ended up that like basically every character in the book is like a little bit of me, some more than others, but yeah.
Do you feel like it could be Tales of the City, Armistead Maupin style, like this could be the start of a whole, you know, journey that goes on for the next decade?
I like that idea. It's hard to know, you know, I'm writing a new one at the moment and it doesn't revisit the same characters.
Right.
But maybe it could. It's hard to say. It felt like the story was quite complete in it. And I guess something that I like the way that this story, it's not straightforwardly happy, but it is, it's got a sort of like optimism.
There's
for the character.
Yeah,
there's hope in it. And I like that that hope can remain at the end of the book, whereas, of course, in the rest of the lives of those characters, there's going to be lots of kind of trials and tribulations. And maybe that hope won't have been well-placed ultimately. But I like being able to leave them in a hopeful place at the end of the book and let that be it for them.
Why June 2019? Is that literally when you started writing the book, or was there something specific about that date?
I started writing the book a little bit before that, but probably March 2019 is when I started writing it. Why then? I mean, partly it is because that's, yeah, when I, around the time that I started writing it. So some of the kind of plot elements that I was gathering at that time felt that they suited it. There were a few other things. So I moved to London in 2017. So I'd been living here a couple of years at that point. But 2019 was the year when things really started to click for me socially. I was in a really good, really exciting time in my life. I was living in a sort of warehouse commune, which is like the one described in the book. Mm-hmm. And that was a really, it was a really amazing time in my life for me. There were 11 other people who lived there. many of whom are still my best friends now. And I was learning a lot about myself. I felt that London was really opening up to me in a way that it felt quite hard at the beginning. I felt I was, you know, I was running into people at the street and the street, I was getting invited to parties. And I was interested in documenting that time with a lot of love and affection, but particularly in the sense that I felt like that time was always on the verge of ending. And I think for a couple of reasons, partly because, so our tenancy in that warehouse, which was, you know, the central part of my life, was very precarious, illegal, in fact. We didn't have any formal contract and, you know, could have been evicted at a moment's notice, which ultimately did go on to happen. And then it was also a sort of time in which, you know, I mean, I guess this has been the case for a number of years, but there's this sense of apocalypse in the air, whether that's sort of like real or perceived. There's this sense that things could go very wrong, like ecologically, politically. And that was something that I felt very conscious of at that time, that I was in the middle of this really special time in my life and that could always be on the verge of ending. And that gave it a sense of urgency. There was a sense of urgency in documenting it with a lot of care and love. And that's sort of what I tried to do with the book. And I guess the other sort of element of it is that a big part of the book is to do with the sense of possibility in a person's life. So a sense that you can look towards the future and you can see yourself in it. And for lots of people, I think that's quite difficult for like economic reasons, for political reasons. It's hard to see yourself in the future. And I was interested in thinking about what it feels like when that is possible and when it's not. And particularly with this book, it's got a relationship to that particular political moment in 2019, leading up to the general election, which happened at the end of that year, and the last year of Jeremy Corbyn's leadership of the Labour Party, which obviously people perceive or think about in lots of different ways now, but certainly at that time, and I still think it's true, proposed like a much more radical shift in policy than has been part of any mainstream political program in this country for, you know, many generations. And that expanded sense of political possibility, I think, did provide the opportunity for a lot of people to look towards the future and see themselves in it. And I was interested in thinking about how that felt politically, but how that might interact with the emotional experience that was going on for me at that time also.
Well, the character of Maggie in it, who I'm obsessed with, is an aspiring artist, but she feels completely shut out by the art world. I found that a fascinating energy, because learning more about you, as we mentioned earlier, said you wanted to be an artist from an early age, but your experience was very welcoming into the art world through queer artists. You had an inspiring art teacher, and it'd be really lovely to talk about your education and how at an early age you were introduced to these queer artists, where not only was you seeing the queer experience in art, but you were seeing celebrated persons who were queer in the public arena, which is something that we all need to see. I'd love you to just talk about that a bit more.
Yeah, sure. So I guess my education, it was a mixed bag in many ways. So I guess when I was in second class in primary school, which is, I'm not sure what the equivalent of that is in UK schools, but it's like 7-8 sort of time. I had a teacher then, Miss McNamara, it's hard to say what was kind of going on for her, in the sense that obviously when you're a child, you don't really imagine like what's motivating an adult to act in this way. But she became very sort of invested in giving the kids like opportunity to access culture, I suppose. So in primary school, we, you know, normally would have gone on, you know, one kind of school outing a year to, you know, a farm or the zoo or something like that. She brought us on all these like additional outings to museums, National Gallery in Dublin, National History Museum, all these kinds of places, which was my first time being in art galleries. And I remember, at that age feeling very, very happy there, very happy in that art gallery. I'm not sure precisely what it was. I mean, I certainly would have found the paintings, you know, impressive. You know, I feel like as a child to see, you know, people rendering these things in paint, particularly, so there's like a really famous like Caravaggio painting in the National Gallery in Dublin, which is like its most famous painting that everyone goes to see. And it's the painting is the Taking of the Christ, and it's, in that painting, there's, there's lots of things going on in that painting. But one of the things is somebody's wearing a suit of armor, and the armor looks really shiny as if it's a photograph, which is kind of mind boggling to a child that you can render that in paint. But beyond that, she took us on that trip to the statue of Oscar Wilde, which is in Merrion Square in Dublin, around the corner from the National Gallery. And that was sort of hugely exciting to me, in the sense that Oscar Wilde was the first time that I'd heard of someone being gay and also loved and celebrated. And I think up until that point, I'd only ever heard of them, you know, being kind of, laughable or disgusting. And this was, it was a huge deal to see and hear that. And from that time, that really, I think I saw being a writer or an artist as a way to be gay and still be loved, because that was the only example that I'd seen of that in adult life. So kind of from that age, I decided that that's what I wanted to do. And so I guess that was one hugely sort of encouraging.
Incredible. I mean, that's so rare. The fact that this teacher gave you agency, not only in your creativity, but in your, in your true self at seven or eight. That's just an amazing gift that she probably has no idea, or maybe she does have an idea. Maybe people have told her, but, that she instilled that in you at that age. That's incredible. Because we had a guest on the other day, Grace Campbell, who, when she was at school, her teacher, and she liked art, and her teacher basically said, if you take art, I will not mark you because I think you have no skill at all. And it stayed with her. So for many years she was being creative, but in the back of her head she was going, I'm not really an artist, I'm not an actor, I'm not a writer, I'm not creative, so I shouldn't be here, everyone's going to laugh at me. And now her life is creativity, and you just think, what, Mrs. McNamara needs a big shout out, because it's changed your life,
What else is really beautiful about that as well is this idea that, like, all kinds of kids, like, everyone's different, and you obviously picked up on the things that you saw yourself in, if that makes sense, but like other kids in your group might have seen themselves in different objects or different paintings or different sculptures. Do you know what I mean?
A suit of armor.
And the thing I love about art is that you can find yourself. You can work out who you are and define yourself by these other objects or artworks. And it's just so important. That's why governments try and shut down art all the time. Because it's like, it's empowering people, really.
Gives
to be
people
themselves.
Agency. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. I think I'm really interested also you've said that your interests in art are through like a lens of class and sexuality. So sexuality, we were just talking about then, but also this class. And I think you've said that class, art is a class signifier. And I'd love to talk about that more, because that's really interesting to me, and I completely get that. But art is a class signifier because so many people are not included in the conversation, and so many people don't have access to it, and so many people are told art isn't for you, and it's only a certain class that are given this rarefied treat as something. And that'd be really fascinating to get your opinion on that.
Yeah, I think it's so complicated that, because I guess there's, I think that like sometimes there's quite a sort of like understandings of, or what the way people talk about art and class, there's a kind of crassness to it sometimes, I think, in the sense that there's this perception that visual art is for the middle class and whatever, popular television is for working class people, in a way that, I find that really sort of like frustrating and dispiriting, in the sense that I do think people are sort of encouraged to think that art isn't for them. That, and I think that comes down to really like practical stuff too, like people feel like they might not know what to do in the gallery. I certainly used to think, like, when I went to galleries with friends, I was like, oh, am I standing in front of the thing for a long enough time? Am I like making the right facial expressions so it looks like I'm engaging with the art? Was that kind of feeling of self-consciousness that I wasn't correctly engaging with it was completely inhibiting to any actual like
of being observed within the art gallery space, that people are watching you watch the art and judging you. It's a real phenomenon that people feel.
I think it's complicated, I guess. So when I was sort of a teenager and increasingly becoming more interested in art, it was something that kind of marked me out from my parents, and over time, like, it sort of like as I started moving in more like art circles, moving in like, it's hard, I mean, it's hard to put a word on it, but what you might call like more like cosmopolitan circles, like it made me like very different from them. You know, use different words, spoke in a different way, had different reference points. And so I suppose that in terms of like my interest in art, that has kind of signified like a shift in class, like of moving in more sort of like, you know, moving in more like middle class, like in fact, like wealthy circles sometimes, which has like coincided with an increased participation in the art world. So I feel complicated about it. Like to me growing up, like art always kind of presented this like way out, like kind of like I was saying with the Oscar Wilde story, it presented this way into being a sort of like queer adult who still got the possibility of being like loved. But it also meant like moving me like quite far away from my background, from my like broader family in a way that is also like painful and complicated. And yeah, it's not a straightforward story.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do it. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Well, you create distance upon the characters and... with a mother and son that is shown because of his interest in art, and that she assumes that he thinks he knows more than her suddenly, or he does know more than her, or he's kind of trying to be something that's not her, and she takes it really personally. And that's a really interesting device. And I think, is that sort of how you're saying about your own family? Because I also know about a story when you were 16 and you went to the Tate Modern and you convinced your family to come with you, and you were really excited and none of them wanted to go, and you sort of had to drag them along.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that it's a painful dynamic, you know? Like, I feel like that thing where when we went to the Tate Modern, it was our first time in London. I really wanted to go. Nobody else did, but my family sort of agreed to come. And again, like I felt really, really good there, you know, in the Tate Modern and in London more broadly at that age. Like that was another kind of key moment where I could really look towards future and see myself in it, you know. Like I felt like this is a place that I want to live and want to be. But my parents definitely were quite like derisive about some of the artwork. They certainly felt it wasn't for them. And I mean, there was something disappointing in some ways for that for me, because I was in the middle of feeling this like really exciting optimism for my own future, like through places like this. And they were so clearly sort of rejecting it. But at the same time, I think I did also like take some pleasure in being like, oh, well, like I'm someone who understands the difficult art. And that, and I think.
What was it you're looking at? Was it something in a turbine hall at that stage that was quite...
Yeah. So it was Doris Salcedo's
The Crack.
The Crack, yeah.
Shibboleth, how'd you say it?
Shibboleth.
Yeah. Shibboleth. And you can still see the crack now. If you stand on the gangway bridge and look down going towards the main entrance, you can see the scarring of the crack.
Yeah, because they filled it in with concrete after. I always remember seeing that work and just being really, I don't know, it was a profound one, because
it was like, how have they done this? It's an optical illusion. Yeah. Why would they do that?
But so also the symbolism of it is like a crack in the ground, you know, of this institution.
And it's sacred,
a hell of a lot. Yeah.
So what did your family think that was a load of old crap, or were they like, yes, did you have to convince them? They did.
Yeah, they did. In terms of convincing them, like, I think, like, at that age, I didn't really have the kind of literacy and vocabulary to say why I thought it was good. And but I mean, I think even now, if I kind of explained why I thought it was, you know, a really exciting artwork with the, you know, vocabulary I have at my disposal now, I still think it maybe wouldn't be convincing to them, which is interesting. Yeah, I mean, I guess there are a lot of people who've got a sort of kind of a hostility towards contemporary art, I guess, hostility towards art that isn't
Sistine Chapel.
Yeah, like figurative painting or
yeah, or like landscapes or like
yeah,
things you immediately recognize. But it's also a skill level, isn't it? It's like that's properly painted.
Yeah, exactly.
That's artist, proper actor. Everything's like that. If it's proper, then it's okay. Yeah, I get it.
It's strange. I'm not sure the way around it, you know. But I guess a figurative painting is, because it's like painting something which is like you can literally like see and understand what it is, it feels more straightforward to form a response to it. But if it's something, you know, more abstract, more experimental, it can be more difficult to form a response. And I think that can feel like a sort of vulnerable place if you're looking at something and feel that you don't get it, and particularly feeling that you might be judged for not getting it. Like, yeah. I think it's a defensive position to say, oh, that, you know, that's ridiculous, whatever, a child could have done it. Like those kinds of things that people say. But also people have got different tastes. Some people just do really, maybe just really don't like it. That's fine also. it's complicated.
I was really touched just then when you said that you felt like when you were in London, it was almost like calling to you. It's like the city gave you a giant hug or something, and that you felt like it was a place that you wanted. It was almost like you had a yearning to go there. And I was interested in the book, this idea of the city in London, and you know, obviously there's a heat wave, but this idea of it as a character and the soul of a city, but also how art and culture, I think, sort of helps to create that soul. Do you know what I mean? Like different cities have different things going on, that especially London, there's like musicals, there's theatre, there's poetry readings, there's just all this kind of depth of culture.
You navigate it by culture, don't you? Especially as a tourist, you do. Like you would navigate London by going, as you did at 16, by going to the Tate Modern. Then you would go to the West End. Culture helps people find their way around a city.
Yeah. But I was really interested in it as a character, basically, because I know you've got all the actual human beings, but it felt to me like the city was its own kind of protagonist or character within the book.
Yeah. No, totally. I mean, I guess one of the things that I find really most exciting about London, and which I wanted to capture in the book, was this sense that anything could happen. Like, particularly on a hot day in the middle of the city, it feels like there's this massive sense of possibility that if you just, you know, turn the street corner, you're going to find something really, really cool. And that thing could potentially change your entire life or just give you, you know, a fabulous time on this particular day. And I think part of that is to do with the access to art and culture, because there are so many like incredibly cool things, and it is possible to stumble upon something very cool. But it's also, I think, also that feeling though is quite elusive. Like the promise of the really cool thing that's going to change your life is like, it often doesn't make good on that promise. In fact, it probably nearly never does. It's quite a high demand. But I'm really interested in that feeling though of being in London on a hot day and feeling that something huge could happen. And I find that quite a pleasurable feeling in itself, in the sense that you're kind of suspended in this longing for this elusive thing. And I was interested in capturing that in the book.
Do you know a lot of artists? Do you hang out with a lot of artists, or do you hang out with a lot of writers?
I hang out with much more artists than writers. I don't know a huge amount of writers. When I lived in Dublin, I knew a lot more writers and poets. But when I moved here, the kind of scene that I landed in was primarily a visual art scene, to an extent, a sort of academic scene and a political scene. But a lot more of my friends are artists. And I feel probably a lot of my my approach to writing is informed a little bit by what sometimes can look like a visual arts approach, particularly in terms of, I guess, like when I start writing, it's quite like I work in quite a kind of collage based way. So I don't start from character or plot, but start with like a set of like aesthetic and thematic concerns and a broader set of like reference points, which sometimes are other novels, but often are like other artworks, songs.
What artworks would you have had them sort of pasted up, like artworks around you, like mood board?
Like on my computer, yeah, but I don't, no physical mood board, but it is like a very mood board process. Like for quite a while at the beginning, like just like gathering all of these things and like emotional textures too, like which actually is that I think part of the big influence that like art has on my writing is that so much art, it creates like a visual or like a visceral emotional texture, which is often something that I try to capture in my writing. Like when I start writing something, the aim is often kind of like, I wanted to like feel like this rather than this is the story and this is the characters.
Who are your artist mates you hang out with?
So I've got a good friend called Avril Caroon, who she is a cross-disciplinary artist, but she works a lot with found material. Her practice is like particularly engaged with, or has been particularly engaged with over the past couple of years, housing, private rental housing in particular. So she did a MFA in Goldsmiths, and for her degree show, she created these luxury cheeses used or made with black mold from private rental accommodation. And she's gone on to make kind of installation work also using
cheese.
Yeah, so these,
so was it edible cheese?
No, it would make you very sick, I think, but but it displayed
highly poisonous.
Yes, yeah. But displayed as kind of like a luxury cheese might be displayed in a high-end shop. Yeah. She's quite fab.
She sounds great. What are your references for on this like computer mood board? Have you got image, like photographs by like Wolfgang Tillmans, for example? I feel would be really
You saw his work, didn't you, at the Pompidou? Because I heard this story of the kiss, which is a picture taken in the Cock nightclub back in the day when it still existed in that location where it was taken. But that got me thinking a lot about this visceral thing you're talking about, because that picture in particular of the kiss is such a iconic image, isn't it?
Yeah. So hugely powerful and visceral. And yeah, I mean, I saw that in the Pompidou recently. They had a sort of like a queer exhibition of like lots of different queer work over the course of the past, I'm not sure, a century maybe. But on the same day, I took like quite a big walk around Paris and went to see Oscar Wilde's grave in the cemetery in the east of the city. And yeah, there was something that I found very moving about that, about like seeing that artwork on that day and then going to see Oscar Wilde's grave, which is sort of covered in these like lipstick marks that people leave in tribute, and feeling very moved to see that, to think about the significance of him to me when I was a child. But Wolfgang Tillmans definitely was on the mood board. I would say actually a lot of photographic work. So Nan Golden's Ballad of Sexual Dependency, another really big one.
Incredible, yes.
Yeah. I mean, I guess her kind of her interest in sort of social history, I guess, the way she documents the social history in this really, you know, beautiful, moving, sometimes funny, like incredibly powerful way, was something that I was interested in playing with in this book. And I think probably for this book, the other big kind of visual art influence was actually Mark Lecky, particularly Fiorucci Made Me Hardcore. That film was again like the sense of social history in that. Also the sense of like youth culture, people having a good time, but particularly the sense of like euphoria. Like I'm interested in that, the feeling of euphoria was something that I was really interested in capturing in this book, which I think is quite a challenging thing to, it's like hard to capture in writing. Like I feel like often it's something that can be better captured through visual art or music. And that sort of like really sublime feeling of like you know, transcendence on the dance floor is something that, yeah, I think you can't really capture it in writing, but I'm interested in what happens and the like striving toward it.
So Oscar Wilde's a big hero of yours then. So like you saw him as a kid, he's been a constant for you. You was in Paris recently, you found his grave. So that was like, you know, a pilgrimage to him. What is it about Oscar Wilde, you know, the fundamentals of him that have stayed with you for so long, do you think?
I think it's not so much about his, I mean, I admire his writing very much. I'd say in terms of his influence on my, like the formal or like thematic content of my work, I'd say it's not necessarily that much, but it's more what he sort of meant symbolically as a child, this like this idea of, you know, being a loved gay person. And I think particularly in the context of Ireland, he's, you know, a massively celebrated figure in Ireland. And that was the only kind of, that was the only visibility I had of that when I was a child.
Why was he celebrated in Ireland?
Because he was, you know, from there, born there. Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that. Yeah. He was born in Ireland.
Yeah, he was, yeah. So part of why I think he was also celebrated, I mean, obviously celebrated for being, you know, a famous, accomplished Irish person, but also I think because he was imprisoned by the British judicial system, it was kind of also perceived as like an additional example of... you know, British violence, whatever, which I think, I mean, that obviously speaks to a kind of Irish sensibility. It confirms something that a lot of people already believe there. So I think I think there's a kind of, people were particularly amenable to him for those reasons as well, I think.
I'm so used to seeing Stephen Fry play him. Did he have an Irish accent, do you think, to begin with?
I think probably not. Yeah, I think probably not. He was sort of like Anglo-Irish, so he would have been of a sort of, you know, English lineage and would have like moved in very, you know, elite circles.
That's what Francis Bacon was. He described himself as Anglo-Irish.
Yeah.
So in the intro, when I described you as a keen observer, do you think that was a fair appraisal?
Yeah. I think, yes, I would say so. In lots of ways, I'm quite a shy person and have been since I was, I mean, forever. I've always been a very shy person since I was a small child. And that means I've spent, you know, a lot of time being quiet in social settings, quiet generally. And I mean, I think when I was a kid, I definitely felt a lot of sort of anguish around that, particularly when I was in primary school, I really very much wanted to have friends, but whatever the quality is that makes people kind of able to instigate and maintain conversations with other people, I didn't have it. But I think, like, I've got, like, as time has gone on, you know, I found ways to, you know, develop that somewhat more. But also, I've like come to realize that actually, like, those periods of feeling, you know, very lonely in lots of ways, were also opportunities to develop my skills of observation, you know, at a certain amount of emotional cost, in the sense that, like, those were, you know, that was like, it was quite sad and difficult to feel that way. But, you know, I'm happy to have emerged into adulthood with a keen eye for social and emotional detail.
Do you think shyness has made you a better artist and a better writer?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely a really big part of it. I mean, I write for lots of reasons, but I think part of the really big impulse in it for me is like a desire to feel seen and understood. I think, like, I've spent quite a long time feeling, not really feeling understood, because I don't make myself understood, or I don't have the means to make myself understood in a lot of social contexts. And like throughout my life and still now, really, you know, often leave kind of parties and feel this sense of kind of despondency at having not really been able to say what I mean, or feeling that there was some kind of, you know, important part of me that I really would have liked to, you know, be seen by those around me, and I wasn't able to make that happen. And like often in those moments, I sort of think, well, you know, maybe they'll read the book and then they'll like understand those things about me. So I think really it is the place that I write from is from a you know, that this deficit of feeling kind of understood in other parts of my life and making up for it through writing, which is quite like, it's quite like a long-winded way to make yourself understood, but using the tools I have to work with. So maybe it's okay. But
I think a lot of writers try to cultivate shyness, a lot of novelists when they become successful, but I think you have it naturally.
Yes.
And I think you have a beautiful energy. I think your shyness is very endearing.
Thank you. That's nice.
So we're gonna get into our final questions now. This has been wonderful. First question we ask every guest is, if you could do an art heist, you could have any artwork in the world for yourself, what would it be and why?
I was thinking about this, and a lot of the artworks that I most love and that mean the most to me are ones which exist, you know, digitally, which are either films or film photographs. And also a lot of them are kind of stuff that's got a sort of like, you know, a sort of like social value. And I've kind of thought, oh, I don't really want to take them out of, the institutions where other people can sort of benefit from them more. But then I thought about it, and in terms of something that I'd actually like to display in my house, it's quite an obvious choice. But you know that like the Martin Parr image of the woman serving the ice cream.
Yeah.
I really love that. And that is something that I feel I would like to display in my house.
Where did you first see that?
Yeah, have you seen it actually in the flesh, or have you just seen it online?
Yeah, I think, I'm not sure if it still is, but was it in the Tate at one point?
It would have been the National Portrait Gallery, you might have seen it.
Yeah, I can't remember.
There was a big exhibition there a few years back.
Yeah. Yeah, I love that.
We'll get you that.
Yeah. Great.
To say thanks.
Sure.
The other question we ask every guest is, what is your favorite color?
I would say pink. Pink is my favorite color. I don't wear any pink. But when I was a kid, I loved pink very much, but I wasn't allowed to wear it. But my mom did. She like dyed my like vests pink, so I could wear like a pink item under my sort of like boy clothes.
Beautiful. You've had so many great like women at a young age just empowering you and giving you agency.
Yeah, I'm very lucky. But I feel like, in honor of my childhood self, I'm staying true to pink.
Oh my God, that's so sweet. There's a kid's book in that. You should write a short book about it.
Yeah,
the pink
it's like
vest.
A kind of armor, isn't it? Or something.
So nice.
Oh my God. Yeah. That made me feel really emotional.
Yeah.
Okay, what is the best advice you've ever received when it comes to your art, whether that be your writing or your performance art? And are you still a performance artist? You still a spoken word artist?
I haven't done it in a long time, but I would quite like to. Yeah, there's a certain kind of kick I get out of it that I don't quite get from writing fiction, but yeah, TBC. Okay. But in terms of advice, yeah, I was mulling this over today and I think it's changed a little bit. So I think the piece of advice, which I got quite early in my career and which did carry me quite a long way, was from somebody who told me, it was to do with, I guess, like taking yourself seriously before other people are taking you seriously. And she basically said to, because I was like, you know, like working full time and lots of different jobs, and you know, continued to do so until quite recently. But she said, in terms of, you know, one day having a like financially viable career as an artist or a writer, you've got to treat it like you're getting paid for it, and you're going to get fired even before that's the case. And I took that really seriously and was very, you know, diligent in getting up every day early before work, staying up late after work to write as if I was going to get fired if I didn't do it. And that really like that like took me quite a long way, and you know, did make my career possible. But at the same time, I've kind of found the limits of it recently as well, in the sense that I can basically write full time now, but I still kind of like try to fill up all of my time with work in a way that is sometimes actually a little bit counterproductive. And a more recent bit of advice, which kind of counterbalances the old version, is also that it's like really important that it's fun and playful, and that if you kind of show up to your desk every day really stressed because you're going to get fired if you don't do it, that's actually quite inhibitive to the kind of like playful, like gentleness that you need to be creative. So I'm trying to like hold that now as well, that it's needs to be fun also.
Okay, have fun, but also feel like you're going to get fired.
Yes, exactly.
Great. So your book's coming out with Fourth Estate Publishers, Fourth Estate Books,
on
they're
the
called.
9th of May.
On the 9th of May.
Yes.
Is it being published in the States as well?
Yeah, so it's out in the States on Mariner Books on July 2nd.
And once it comes out in May in the UK and Ireland, I take it, mm-hmm. Are you on like a big book tour? Like you're doing loads of junkets? Are you doing readings and stuff? What have you got lined up?
Yeah, so there's quite a few things happening in the UK in May. So I'm doing quite a few events in London. So in Waterstones on Trafalgar Square on May 9th, Birdie Fisher in Hackney, Gay's the Word, and I think some others. And then, yeah, others around the UK. So I'm doing something in Bath, Margate. Yeah, I can't remember. There's a bunch, but info can be found on my Instagram.
Brilliant. Well, that's excellent. Well, this has been amazing talking to you, Oisin. Thank you so much for your book, your novel, and for giving us your time today. And I hope that everybody listening will buy your book because it's bloody brilliant. It's incredibly moving and compelling and funny. And I just want to hang out with all those people. So thank you.
Yeah, thanks so much. It's lovely to chat.
It is definitely a book where you feel like you could have actually been there. It's almost like it mixes up with your memory and then you kind of feel like it was your life. I think, but maybe because it's such recent history as well, if you know what I mean. Like it's set in a year where we actually did live. So for everyone listening, you can pre-order or buy the book now and Fourth Estate Evening and Weekends. And are you on Instagram?
Yes, it's Oish, so OIS _ MCK91.
Great. Well,
we will link to that as well.
You should get a rush of followers now.
For listening. And hope to see you very soon.
Oh, thanks so much.
Good luck.
Bye. Bye.
You've been listening to Talk Art with Robert Diamond and Russell Tovey.
Follow us on Instagram @TalkArt, where you can view images of all artworks discussed in today's episode, with music by Jack Northover.
Subscribe to Talk Art at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Acast, or wherever it is that you get your podcasts.
Give us a rating and write us a comment. Thanks for listening. We'll be right back.